Good morning. On today's programme, Poland holds elections to determine its next government and how Independence Day in Nigeria has lost some of its significance. But first we go to Israel, and after the deadliest attack in the country's history, when Hamas militants killed more than 1,300 people last weekend, Israel responded with deadly force, declaring war on Hamas and pounding the Gaza Strip with bombs. Tensions have never been higher in the region as the next stage of the conflict begins. As Hannah McCarthy reports now from Israel.
The train picked up speed as it left Beersheba, the largest city in southern Israel. It was a Saturday, the Jewish day of Shabbat, when trains don't normally run in Israel. But today was different. After a devastating massacre by Palestinian militants, which left 1,300 dead, not far from Beersheba, Israel declared war on Gaza and the militant group known as Hamas, which controls it. Now, trains are running every day in order to bring Israeli soldiers and reservists returning from abroad to the Gaza border and to the northern border with Lebanon. My carriage was full of young Israeli soldiers who had spent the last week dealing with the aftermath of the Hamas massacre in towns and kibbutzes around southern Israel. They were jumpy. When I returned to my seat after going down to the lower deck of the train to charge my phone, I found them panicking. They thought the bag I had left on my seat was a bomb. One of the Israeli soldiers asked where I was from. When I said I was from Ireland, she explained her mother was born in Belfast in the 60s and had later moved to Israel. "It's a very difficult time here now," she said. Just 50 kilometres away from us, Palestinians in Gaza are facing an unrelenting campaign of aerial strikes that have wiped out whole families and levelled neighbourhoods. I spoke with Yara Alaga, an Irish Palestinian with 10 family members in Gaza, who was trying to leave after Khan Yunis, the town where they were living, came under heavy attack. For days she has been messaging her family, which includes 5 children, all under the age of 7, and trying to help them find a way out. After a total blockade was imposed by Israel, their only hope is through the Rafah crossing between Egypt and Gaza. Israel is refusing to facilitate humanitarian corridors and safe passages for innocent civilians to leave, she says. Seeking revenge for the devastating massacre by Hamas, Israel is eager to inflict the maximum damage on Gaza, while Egypt is fearful of an outpouring of Palestinian refugees into its borders. Gazan Palestinians themselves are fearful that if they cross into Egypt, they may never be allowed back into Gaza, much like the 1948 Nakba, when they were expelled from their land in Palestine when the State of Israel was formed. Yara feels deeply frustrated with the reaction to the war in Gaza by EU leaders. On her recent visit to Israel, EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen emphasised Israel's right to defend itself, with little mention of its obligations under international humanitarian law. Yara believes the EU leader's rhetoric on her visit to Israel has emboldened the country's attack on Gazan civilians and given them little incentive to open the only civilian crossing now between Gaza and the outside world. She believes Ursula von der Leyen has completely failed to provide international protection for EU citizens and recognise their human right to life, safety, self-determination and freedom. The events of the 7th of October have plunged Israel and Palestine into an unprecedented crisis and threatens to engulf the region and draw in actors from across the Middle East, including Iran, Lebanon, Qatar, the UAE and Egypt. And there is still no end in sight. The coming weeks promise more upheaval for the region, with Israeli and Palestinian civilians so far paying the biggest price. In southern Israel, I'm Hannah McCarthy for World Report.
To Poland next, where voters are casting their ballots in a general election today in what has been a very polarised campaign between the ruling nationalist Law and Justice Party and the main centrist opposition led by former Prime Minister Donald Tusk. Immigration and national security have become the main talking points in this country of almost 40 million people. From Warsaw, Liam Nolan reports.
In a marketplace in Minsk Mazowiecki, a town about 50 kilometres east of Warsaw, stallholders sell local fruit and vegetables. Fresh tomatoes, yellow and red peppers and courgettes are on display. And lots of sausages too, or kiełbasa, as they're called in Polish. Your reporter was getting hungry. The town is a safe seat for the ruling nationalist populist Law and Justice Party, which is seeking a third term in government in today's general election. In the 2019 election, Law and Justice won 50% of the vote in this district. The centrist opposition won just a quarter of local votes. So Minsk Mazowiecki seemed like a good place to visit and find out what the locals thought of the current government. "I am for Law and Justice, and nothing more than that," says Anna, a meat seller in her 50s. She proceeds to tell me that she is against immigration, like they have in Germany. "We should help people out, but in their own countries, not here," she says. Immigration and national security, given the close proximity of the war in Ukraine, have become the two main topics of the campaign. Both issues have been driven by Law and Justice. But voter surveys have shown that the cost of living and public health care, followed by national security, are the three biggest issues that people care about. At the market, Leszek, another meat seller, tells me that Law and Justice have done a lot of good for us. He talks about how the government has helped families, referring to a generous child benefit scheme which Law and Justice introduced in 2016 and which it has pledged to increase if it wins the election. Leszek also tells me that the referendums are a good idea. He is referring to four referendum questions that Poles will also vote on today, in addition to casting their ballots for the parliamentary and Senate elections. The four questions were proposed by Law and Justice in August. Two of the referendum questions deal with immigration. One asks voters if they are in favour of illegal immigration and the European Union's latest migration relocation pact, which Poland and Hungary vetoed in June. Centrist and left-wing opposition parties argue that the ruling party is using the referendum questions to promote its own parliamentary election agenda. But not everyone at the market in Minsk Mazowiecki is a fan of Law and Justice. Krzysztof, a 70-year-old farmer who is retired but sells his own vegetables at the market, tells me that the current government is the worst since communism. He tells me that he will vote for the party with the biggest chance of removing Law and Justice, and that means former Prime Minister Donald Tusk's centrist Civic Coalition. Krzysztof says he's against giving easy money to people, meaning higher social security payments, and says he's never had a problem with immigration. Poles also emigrated, he tells me. Mr. Tusk was the president of the European Council from 2014 to 2019 and returned to Polish politics 2 years ago. He is a true Europhile and to his supporters a symbol of a progressive, successful Poland at the heart of the EU. His centrist coalition supports civil union for same-sex couples and abortion up to the 12th week of pregnancy. Earlier this week, I went to meet Andrzej Bobiński, the editor-in-chief of Polityka Insight, a political magazine at his office in central Warsaw. Over coffee, he told me that Law and Justice has built a narrative that there is a very dangerous world outside of Poland's borders, and that it states that it is the only party that can safeguard the traditional Catholic version of Polish life. Various polls show that Law and Justice leads the centrist opposition by between 5 and 8 points. But neither of the two biggest parties look likely to win a simple majority, meaning smaller parties could play a role in shaping a new coalition government. For Poles, that means more of the same, or a broad centrist opposition that resets relations with the EU. For World Report, this is Liam Nolan in Warsaw.
Finally, we go to Nigeria, which held a public holiday earlier this month to mark its Independence Day. The day was once a prominent national celebration, but in recent times it has lost its significance, as Nigeria's people have more pressing concerns. Pulum David reports from Abuja.
Sunday, October 1st, marked 63 years of Nigeria's independence from colonial rule. The theme for the anniversary was Nigeria at 63, Renewed Hope for Unity and Prosperity. This year's commemoration was low-key, but that's how President Tinubu wanted it. The government cited economic challenges as a reason for the quiet celebration. Many years ago, Independence Day was a vital national celebration. I remember while I was in high school, we looked forward to October 1st annually to showcase our colorful parades before many dignitaries who flew in to honor Nigeria. It was a beautiful sight. But now, low-key celebrations of Independence Day have become the norm in Nigeria. However, an Independence Anniversary public lecture was conducted and prayers at the National Mosque and an interdenominational church service were held to pray for the peace and progress of the country. President Tinubu also delivered a nationwide broadcast on the day of the anniversary. A public holiday was declared to honor the day. But for most people, it was just a regular holiday with little or no significance to them. The first day was nothing worth celebrating. Nigeria, the giant of Africa, is blessed with vast human and natural resources. Sadly, youth unemployment, inflation, and debt are at an all-time high. More than 60% of the country lives in what United Nations refers to as multidimensional poverty. Constant power supply is still a challenge, especially as the country's national grid collapsed multiple times this year alone. This is President Tinubu's first independence celebration. He took over power after winning an election many Nigerians felt was marred by allegations of vote buying and voter intimidation. As soon as President Tinubu resumed office in May, he announced the removal of fuel subsidy, which had a ripple effect on the cost of living crisis in the country. And he also devalued Nigeria's currency, the Naira. Despite all this, some Nigerians, like the presidential candidate of the Labour Party in the February 25th general election, Peter Obi, believe that Nigerians should remain resolute and hopeful, saying a new Nigeria is still possible. Also, the president of Nigeria's Senate, Godswill Akpabio, concurred by saying despite the challenges the country is facing, there is hope for a better tomorrow. He said in industries like music, sports and movies, Nigerians were doing well on a global stage and deserved commendation, saying it should spur a sense of hope. But while these sweet messages were being shared to fill the air with hope and love, Nigeria's labor unions were gearing up to embark on strike over petrol subsidy removal. The labor union's leadership said the continued mismanagement of Nigeria's resources had made it difficult for citizens to make sustainable progress. The current minimum wage of 30,000 naira, which is about $40, has been protested against, as workers say these amounts cannot even purchase a bag of 50 kg of rice. After much deliberation between the government and the leadership of the labor union, the government agreed to grant a wage award of 35,000 naira to all federal government workers beginning in September, pending when a new national minimum wage is expected to have been signed into law. The government also considers suspending collection of value-added tax on diesel for 6 months beginning from October 2023. Additionally, the government agreed to vote 100 billion naira for the provision of high-capacity compressed natural gas buses for mass transit in the country to reduce the cost of transportation. The government further agreed to pay 25,000 naira per month for 3 months starting from October 2023 to 15 million households, including vulnerable pensioners. After hearing all this, the labor unions chose to suspend their planned indefinite strike for 30 days. They had initially scheduled to begin the strike on Tuesday, October 3rd, 2 days after Nigeria's 63rd anniversary. At the moment, however, Nigerians are optimistic that the government will keep to its word to alleviate the pains and sufferings of citizens this 63rd year. For World Report in Abuja, Nigeria, this is Palum David.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The program was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.